Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Browse the self-help section of any bookstore, and you're bound to find an entire bookcase devoted to infidelity. And most of the titles will be a variation on one question: why do men cheat? In the animal world, science has long pointed to the idea that for the majority of males, it's advantageous to mate with as many partners as possible, thus ensuring at least some of his offspring, as well as his genes, will survive. But what about females? Is there a benefit for the females of a species to mate with multiple partners? To find the answer, scientists have delved into the mating habits of birds, specifically the bobolink. Amy Matthews Amos writes about wildlife and the environment. Virginia talked to her about her recent article for Pacific Standard, Why They Stray, The Evolutionary Advantages of Infidelity.
So tell us specifically about the bobolink. What makes this particular bird a good study for determining evolutionary advantages of infidelity?
Well, I don't know that the bobolink was particularly ideal bird to do it. It's just that it was a little bit of chance. It was sort of timing. In the 1980s, I had the opportunity to, as an undergraduate at Cornell University, to spend a summer as a field assistant for my advisor, Tom Gavin, who was studying the mating behavior of bobolinks. And he was looking at male behavior and female behavior, and it sort of turned out that the technology at the time led to some interesting findings. So bobolinks are grassland nesting birds. They migrate thousands and thousands of miles from their wintering grounds in South America to nest in the northeastern United States in the summer. And so we were looking at, well, when the males arrive and then the females, what are the males' territories? Who's matching up with whom? And let's learn something about their feeding behavior and their offspring and their success. And it was pretty obvious, and everybody already knew at the time, that some males had more than one female mate. On the surface, these pairs looked like pairs were monogamous. The male would help his primary female feed the young in the nest. You would see him come and go. But elsewhere in his territory, in some cases, were what we called secondary and even tertiary females.
Well.
Yes. He didn't help these females feed the youngsters, but they clearly were benefiting from all the caterpillar larvae on his apparently particularly rich territory. And so these females said, well, it's a trade-off. Well, I mean, obviously, let's not anthropomorphize too much. These birds aren't consciously choosing this, but their process was, well, this looks like a good place to mate because there's a good territory here. There's a good song, a good male defending the territory, so this is where I'm going to go.
Okay, so the males had their secondary and tertiary females. How about the females?
Well, that's where the DNA analysis came in. Part of the study included taking blood samples from every bird in the field. So we took blood samples from the males, we took blood samples from all the females, and we took blood samples from the nestlings once they got strong enough for that. And the DNA analysis showed that some of the nestlings in each nest were sired by more than one father.
Oh, my.
So it was, you know, it was pretty obvious from looking around the field that some of the males had more than one female mate. But, of course, you can't just tell from looking out in a field that some of the females were obviously had mated with other non-mate males in order to produce eggs that were sired by other males. It's not really very easy to catch birds copulating, so the blood test was what revealed it. And it was the timing of this that really resulted in it being bobolinks. It was just a question of electrophoresis, a new technique at the time that was becoming readily available to ornithologists to start making these kinds of comparisons very easily from blood tests.
So given the study on bobolinks, is there any more information about whether or not female infidelity happens in other bird species?
Oh, absolutely. So once the bobolink study came out, and there was one other study at about the same time, which was in acorn woodpeckers in New Mexico, other biologists started looking for this. And they found that most passerine bird species, that is perching birds, actually have the same pattern. So In 1968, a famous ornithologist, David Lack, had proclaimed that about 90% of bird species were monogamous. In other words, they were just pair bonded. They just mated with each other, and that polyandry, which is the term that's used to describe when females have more than one male mate, that was very, very rare.
Hmm.
But once biologists started looking at this, they found the opposite was true. And by about 2002, I think it was, a review of all the literature that had been done in the previous two decades showed that actually it was the opposite. It was close to 90% of the passerine bird species actually were polygamous in the sense that males and females were mating with, or at least certainly the females were mating with other males who were not their social mate. And only about 14% of species, this did not occur. So it's very, very common. And that's what got evolutionary biologists thinking, well, if this is occurring across so many species, it seems like there must be an evolutionary reason for this. And what could those reasons be?
Well, I'd love to hear more about that evolutionary advantage because, you know, we look at male and female birds of all animal species very frequently. The male is the beauty, you know, he's the one who builds the bower bird nest, the peacock with the gorgeous tail, and the female is kind of usually dun-colored and not that interesting. Is this, what is the advantage to females of a species having more than one baby daddy, for lack of a better word?
Well, there are several reasons. One of them is genetic diversity. So by mating with more than one male, the female can increase the diversity of the genes within her offspring. And genetic diversity is sort of a hedge against changing environmental conditions. So, for example, if one of her offspring is, you know, retains fat very well, shall we say, during a lean year, that offspring is probably going to do better than somebody who doesn't retain fat very well. On the other hand, if there's another year where, let's say, predation is very high, if she has another offspring that's small and fast, then he might do better in those years. So by having different male sire her offspring, she gets a diversity of genes in her gene pool. And of course, evolution is all about perpetuating traits that increase the likelihood that your offspring will survive and reproduce. That's really all that it's about. That's what drives it. So that's one benefit. Another is so-called good genes. So some males, shall we say, just have super-duper genes for a variety of different traits, perhaps. And her social mate may not have all those traits. Maybe her social mate has a really good territory, and she likes that. And again, let's not anthropomorphize too much. It's really not about liking. It's just that that's what she's drawn to. But by having sex with a neighboring male who might have superior genes, she can make sure that some of her offspring have those good genes as well. And then, of course, there always is the resource question that comes into this. Females are going to want a mate that's going to have, in the case of bobolinks, for example, a territory that's going to support raising her offspring until they can fledge successfully. And so she's going to want that that aspect of a mate as well.
So resources, territory, genetic punch. Could we apply any of those kind of theories or ideas to human beings? I mean, could there be any evolutionary benefit for human females to stray?
Well, of course, eventually that's a question that biologists started asking, and largely anthropologists, I should say. And so in the past decade or so, anthropologists such as Brooke Shelza at UCLA, and I spoke with her for the article about her research with the Himba people of Namibia. And so she wanted to talk with people in a community who don't use, shall we say, Western forms of birth control. There's natural fertility. But to do so in a culture where extramarital affairs actually aren't as large a stigma as they are in many other cultures. And so in the Himba of Namibia, extramarital affairs are not uncommon. They are generally discussed fairly openly. And the you know, the implications, the perhaps negative implications from a social standpoint, aren't as great as they might be in other places. And what she found in her interviews was that about a third of the women did have offspring from extramarital relationships, and those women had had greater reproductive success, meaning they had more offspring than those who did not. And of course, reproductive success is a measure of whether there's an evolutionary advantage there. Your goal is to pass on your genes to the next generation, as much of your gene pool as much of your genes into the gene pool as possible.
So that is one group that was studied. You point out others, the Bari people of Venezuela and the Musul, if I'm saying that properly, in China. Any indications among those groups that infidelity might be actually advantageous?
Well, among the Bari, apparently there is. And Stephen Beckerman of Penn State University has found that in the Bari people of Venezuela, people there believe in a concept called partible paternity, which means they believe that a child can actually have more than one biological father. And so in those cases, if a woman has sex with more than one man before and during her pregnancy, the belief is that all of those men are fathers of the child. And his research showed that children who had multiple fathers, at least they were recognized as having multiple fathers, were more likely to survive to adulthood than those who did not. And the thinking there was that these children and or their mothers were getting some additional resources that were provided by these other men who considered these children their children as well.
Amy, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with Amy Matthews Amos. Amy Matthews Amos writes about wildlife and the environment. There's a link to her Pacific Standard article on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.